Austin, 42 on the Vineyard.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It lost over $1 billion this year, and since its inception in 1971, Amtrak has received $23 billion in federal subsidies. Enough is enough, some senators say. It's time to dissolve the struggling railroad monopoly. But might Amtrak still prove that the future of travel is on the ground, not in the air? First, not everyone is jumping aboard the economic stimulus package. The bill passed the House but is stalled in the Senate. Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her if the stimulus package has been derailed and who's behind the derailing.
I would say it is definitively derailed, and it's odd because there actually was agreement on the heart of the proposal, which is rebates for low-income workers and reducing the income tax rate, giving some incentives to business to invest in new equipment and extension of unemployment benefits. There was a real impasse over health care, how to deal with extending Medicaid payments, which is what the Democrats wanted to do, or providing incentives for people to buy their own health insurance, which is what the Republicans wanted to do. But there was agreement on a lot of this. But I think in the end it derailed because people really would rather have the issue.
Meaning they'd rather have it to chew over in the political seasons to come.
That's right. This really felt like campaign speeches at the end of this debate.
Tell us technically what happened first. The House passed a bill.
The House passed its own version of the bill. That is, there had been bipartisan discussions going on across the aisle and across houses that actually was making a lot of progress, and Republicans abruptly walked out of that, marked up their own version. It passed the House on a close partisan vote, and the Senate refused to take it up, started work on their own proposal, which also became very partisan. Some people think as a response to the way the Republicans did it.
So does this mean that our ailing economy will not have government assistance in being revived?
Well, actually, there has been a great deal of new government spending already, both in the appropriations and the emergency, you know, bills that were passed immediately after 9/11. The big tax cut that was passed last spring has already started kicking in. More of it's coming next year. So there's a lot of money coming into this economy.
There was even talk that the stimulus package was unnecessary, possibly even potentially damaging. Is that thinking still going around?
Well, it is. A number of economists were suggesting that every time government tries to pass a stimulus program when the economy is in a downturn, it usually takes so long to get the thing off the ground that by the time the money actually reaches the economy, things have improved. And perhaps it even reaches the economy at a time when things have improved so much that it could be inflationary. There's a real debate among economists about this.
Doesn't the White House run a risk that the economy continues to falter and that the Republican leadership and President Bush will be seen as having derailed a plan that might have saved it, just as we're coming into election season next year?
Well, they did something very, very clever, I think, this week by having the president himself come to the Hill, a sort of rare appearance, to promote a centrist compromise that was reached at the last minute. Now, it only involved about three Democrats, so it's not exactly a bipartisan plan. It never could have gotten 60 votes on the floor of the Senate. Nonetheless, it does give the edge to the White House and the Republicans to be able to say, we have gone the extra mile on this, and the fact that the Democrats won't bring it to the floor of the Senate for vote means that they're the ones who are obstructionist. So you're going to see in the next few days and weeks a lot of blame sharing on this one, you know, who really is to blame for obstructing this program. But scratch beneath the surface, there are actually a lot of senators and members of the House who were wondering if it's really worth spending hundreds of billions of dollars on a program that may not be necessary.
And Gail, beside the finger-pointing over blame, what are the main political messages that the Republicans and the Democrats, as you say, would like to take out of this to take into the campaign season?
Well, I think the Democratic message is very clear. They're taking the most extreme version of the stimulus plan, which is the first one that the House passed. And they're saying, look at the benefits that this is giving to large corporations. Now, that wasn't the whole of the plan, but it was a big piece of it. And for some corporations, IBM, General Motors, it was the repeal of corporate minimum tax would have meant, and retroactive repeal of it, meant hundreds of millions of dollars, in some cases over a billion. The Democrats will take that single instance In fact, the payment to IBM has already been repeated many times by Democratic politicians and say, look, what Republicans are about is helping rich people, period. They don't care about the unemployed.
And the Republican line out of this?
Republican line out of this is, we want to grow the economy. To grow the economy, you need to encourage people to invest. The people that are invest are businesses, and there's nothing wrong with being a business. It's interesting because that's the point that President Clinton's whole administration was about, bringing Democrats back to the point where they could say, we too support growth in the economy.
So is that over now, you're saying?
Well, I think the Democrats are staking out a ground that looks different than what the Clinton position was on that point, and they're going to have some ground to make up if they're interested in maintaining that center position.
And by the time midterm elections roll around next fall, the public will have its own view of whether or not all this political fighting produced something valuable or something awful.
A year is an eternity in politics. I think by the time the election comes around, all of this may be forgotten. It's a long time to keep an issue like this alive. I think in the end, people are going to look at how the economy is doing, look at who the incumbents are, and vote their pocketbooks. If there is a kind of golden rule of political analysis, that's it.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from Washington. The terrorist attacks of September 11th forced travelers to look at alternative means of transportation, cars, buses, and trains. But although Americans showed increased interest in rail travel, the number of Amtrak passengers actually fell in the fall. And as Amtrak continues to flounder financially, critics question if the operation will ever be able to make ends meet. Can Amtrak survive? What are your Amtrak stories? Do you think there's a future in rail travel in the United States? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is former governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis. He's acting chairman of Amtrak's board of directors. Good evening and welcome, Governor Dukakis.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Michael Dukakis, what is the argument for rail travel?
Well, it's perfectly obvious. Our highways are locked in gridlock. Prior to the 11th of September, we had wing lock at our airports. Now it's even worse. And we made a very dumb decision way back after World War II. We decided, unlike the Europeans and the Japanese, that automobiles and airplanes would do the job. And it's clear they can't unless you have a first-class, modern, high-speed rail system in this country. We're doomed to this kind of everlasting congestion and chaos and frustration and road rage and air rage and the rest of it. And the new Acela Express between Boston and Washington is a great example of what we need everywhere. It's going gangbusters. The number of passengers has doubled in the past 3 months. We're going to make about $180 million in net profit in the first year alone. And there are 38 states around the country that are screaming for high-speed rail, and I think it's about time the nation got with them.
We're going to talk about Acela a little later in the hour, but talk to us first about that hinge point you described. After World War II, when the country turned to roads and to air, what happened? Why wasn't rail at the table?
Well, it's an interesting question. Remember, historically, rail passenger service in this country was run by private rail companies. Now, in point of fact, even prior to World War II, they were subsidizing a lot of their passenger operations with the profits from freight. But after World War II, as the taxpayers' money began being poured into highways and airports by the billions, and by the way, when people talk about the amount of money that's gone to support Amtrak, I think the total amount of federal money that's gone to support Amtrak in 30 years is $23 billion. Compare that with the $750 billion, nearly $1 trillion, that's gone into highways and airports. Well, the railroads themselves were suffering from poor management, from a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But in fairness to the railroad managers, some of whom really did want to build modern high-speed rail, when you had these billions in federal subsidies subsidizing the truckers and the buses and the airlines, and virtually nothing going into rail, you can hardly be surprised that they lost the battle. And by the 60s, the private railroads really had made a mess of things. Those of us, and I'm one of them, old enough to remember what it was like at that time, know that it was really a mess. And that's what created Amtrak. People, obviously, and by the way, this was in the Nixon administration, quite obviously didn't want to lose our entire rail passenger system, and so they created Amtrak to take this over and run it as a public service corporation, and that's what we've been attempting to do ever since.
And it's never exactly worked out, and anybody who's traveled it much has all kinds of conflicted feelings about it. You want to get on the train, you want it to be wonderful and magical and efficient and clean, and sometimes it is, and a lot of times it's not. Can it ever work out? What's
sure,
your vision?
Sure.
Well, what's your vision, and how do we get to it?
We have to do exactly the same thing for rail that we've been doing for highways and airports for decades. We've got to create a railroad trust fund with an earmarked source of revenue. That's what pours the billions into the highway trust fund and the airport trust fund. $33 billion a year, federal dollars, for highways, $12 billion for airports, and $331 million from Amtrak. Is that ridiculous? So what we're asking, and what has to be done, should have been done a long time ago, is to create a railroad trust fund, just like the highway and airport trust fund, earmark specific revenue sources to go into it, and then begin investing seriously in Acela Expresses all over America. And if we do that, we'll have a first-class rail system, and we'll have much less congestion on our highways and at our airports.
But money is scarce on all fronts. How did the railroads lose the political battle, and how do they get political leverage back to get the kind of money you're talking about?
Now, money is not scarce. I mean, it wasn't more than a year ago when we were looking at a federal surplus of about $250 billion.
And now, we're not now.
Well, we gave it away in the form of huge tax cuts, mostly to the wealthy, and that's a judgment that the new administration and the Congress made, and they made it. But nobody's going to tell me that this country, the most affluent and the most powerful country in the face of the earth, that's pouring nearly $50 billion into highways and airports every year, can't afford $2 to $3 billion in capital investment in first-class high-speed rail, and that's essentially what we're talking about, 2.5% of the total national transportation budget. Compare that with the French, who put 25 to 30% of their national transportation budget into rail. So when we go to France and we get on the TGV and we say, wow,
it's
isn't
great.
This terrific?
Why don't we have this?
Why don't we have it? It's because the French invest a lot of money in building those terrific high-speed rail lines, and that's what we have to do, although, frankly, we're not talking about a huge amount of money here. We're not talking about more than $2-3 billion a year. And compared to what we're spending on highways and airports, that's chump change. But I'm very excited, very optimistic. The Acela Express is doing incredibly well. And frankly, it's just beginning to grow.
Michael Dukakis, give us some of the numbers nationwide on ridership, on trends in ridership on Amtrak, on on-time arrivals, if they keep track of those. How does all that look?
Well, let me correct one thing you said in the introduction. Our ridership is up. We carried 1 million more people last year than we had at any time in Amtrak's history. And
The numbers we got were from Amtrak PR about ridership since September 11th.
Well, one of the things that's happened to the travel market, as everybody knows, is it's collapsed. Now, we're not immune to that. So our long-distance trains, which are largely leisure and recreational trains, have already obviously taken the same kind of hit that other forms of transportation are. But
so what's the big trend then?
Well, the trend is in the Acela. We will have carried our millionth passenger by Saturday. We've doubled ridership in the past 3 months, and I think that's just the beginning. People love it. I was on the Acela Express from Washington to Boston last night after an Amtrak board meeting. Mm. It was packed. I mean packed, largely with business travelers who used to take the shuttle and have discovered that
there's another way.
Downtown to downtown beats it by a mile, and you can work and you can relax and you can plug in a computer, a laptop. And they're just taking to this, and this is not just a Northeast phenomenon. The southeastern states are screaming for this. The voters of Florida in the famous November 2000 election
Bush Florida.
Not only were hanging chads or whatever else was going on, they voted for an amendment to the Florida Constitution mandating a high-speed rail system in Florida. The Gulf Card, 9 Midwestern states, California, the Northwest, they all want this. They need it. Their highways are choking to death and their airports are a mess. And I think if we have any sense in this country, we're going to begin investing in this. And believe me, people will come.
We're talking about the future of rail travel in the United States, about the future of Amtrak. Have you switched from air to rail since September 11th? If you have, did it work for you? If you haven't, what's holding you back? Have you ridden the rails lately? How was it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're here with Michael Dukakis. Have you ridden the Acela train? Did it accelerate you? Will you use it again? Join us or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S. rail system and Amtrak. Have you switched from air to rail since September 11th? Is it working for you? Have you tried it? Would you do it again? Have you ridden the Acela train? We're here tonight with Michael Dukakis. He's acting chairman of Amtrak's board of directors, former governor of Massachusetts, and as you can hear, a big enthusiast for rail travel and for Amtrak. Are you equally enthused? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Michael Dukakis, we hear your passion for rail travel, but have we missed our opportunity? Europe has got bullet trains going faster and faster. Japan has them going faster and faster. Can we ever get together the kind of right-of-way, the kind of track system, the kind of technology and clearance to have that in the United States, or are we stuck with some kind of hybrid between the old and the new?
Well, it's a bit of a hybrid, Tom. Although, remember, the Acela, which is operating on conventional tracks, hits top speeds of 150 miles an hour.
Compared to what in France and
190?
Japan?
And, of course, they're on exclusive rights of way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are opportunities to build exclusive rights of way in the United States. I spend 3 months of my life at UCLA in the wintertime, which is not a bad gig. Kitty and I have been doing that now for 6 or 7 years. California now has 33 million people. It's going to have 50 million people by the year 2025. And anybody who's tried to drive on the California freeways knows that they're hopeless. And anybody who's tried to get to Los Angeles Airport at 5 o'clock in the afternoon knows that it's almost impossible. So my own view is that in California, they desperately need, beginning now, a Japanese or European-type high-speed train, 200 miles an hour, on exclusive rights of way. And in California, especially up that I-5 corridor, you can do that. And, in fact, the California High-Speed Rail Authority, which is an official state body, has recommended and is now working on a plan which will connect San Diego, Riverside, Los Angeles, San Jose, San Francisco, and Sacramento with 200-mile-an-hour trains, mostly on exclusive rights of way. Now, can you do it in California? Yes. Can you do it in certain other parts of the country? Yes. You can't do it in the Northeast. There just isn't the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have is a terrific train. It won't go 190, but its top speeds are 150.
And describe the Acela for us. What's it like in the interior for those who haven't ridden compared to, let's say, the shuttle, the flight?
There's no comparison. I mean, the experience on the Acela makes first class on an airplane look like a cattle car. You've got plenty of room. You can walk around. You can plug in a laptop. We have tables, and many business people get on in Boston, get on in New York, and have a meeting on the way to their destination. You arrive in the downtown. You're not paying some cabbie $30-$35 to fight his way from LaGuardia into downtown New York. I mean, it's just it's a superior travel experience. But what's different about the Acela from the old trains we had is that they get there a heck of a lot faster, not as fast as they will. We're gradually working our way down to about 3 hours from Boston to New York and about 2 hours and 30 minutes, 2 hours and 20 minutes from Washington to New York. And if we can get some of this capital investment that I'm talking about, then we'll be able to make some of the improvements that will do that there. But the exciting thing is not just the Northeast Corridor. It's extending the Northeast Corridor to Atlanta, which the governors of Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia are demanding. It's a 9-state plan for the Midwest, well-developed now by Amtrak and the 9 Midwestern states. And we work in partnership with the states all the time.
And what's the price tag?
Well, approximately $2 to $3 billion a year. That's what we really ought to be investing in this over a period of time. Obviously, you're not going to do it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Midwest, we're talking a 9-state plan that connects every one of the major Midwestern cities with Chicago as the hub. In the far west in California, 4 corridors. By the way, one of which already today is the fastest growing rail corridor in America.
Which is that?
That's San Jose to Sacramento, the so-called capitals,
mm-hmm.
in freeway heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because if you try to drive around the Bay Area, you know you can't move. And, of course, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, British Columbia, which is also underway and with new trains, but could be speeded up and made much more effective and a much faster train.
We're talking with Mike Dukakis about the future of Amtrak and the U.S. rail system. What do you think? Are you ready to see the U.S. government spend more on the U.S. rail system, on Amtrak? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ted is on the line. Welcome, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening,
Governor.
Good evening.
I share your enthusiasm for rail transport, and I use it every day to go to work. But I think it is fair to say that as far as the highway system is concerned, we may call it federal money, but I think the bulk of it was fuel tax. So the people who are actually using those roads were paying for them.
Yeah, but remember this, the buses, the bus companies and the truckers, and of course we're competing with the bus companies, aren't paying their capital cost yet. You and I may be paying, but they're getting a huge capital investment thanks to us.
Did you buy that, Ted?
I tell you, I don't know anybody who really wants to ride the bus.
Well, a lot of people do.
I suspect they do it out of.
And of course, the airlines, as we know, get $12 billion a year in airport construction subsidies and in direct subsidies for what is called essential service to underserved communities. And that was before the $15 billion bailout.
Ted, would you mind seeing some of the gasoline tax go to the rail system?
Well, I think the problem is this, of course, is a very complex subject, but I know the politics of it are complex, but I think the core issue that I'd like to hear the governor talk about is, do we have the ability to really look at a national rail system in a country as large as this with as diverse movements as we have? And should we instead take a smaller bite of the apple and for, let's say, the next 5 or even 10 years, focus our capital and our efforts on the Northeast Corridor and, let's say, San Diego, San Francisco?
Mike Dukakis, thanks, Ted, for your call. Mike Dukakis, what about it? Too soon to extend over the whole country?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, as I pointed out just a few minutes ago, we're already under construction between D.C. and Richmond on a much improved, higher speed leg of this new Atlantic corridor. Same is true between Raleigh and Charlotte. The governor of Georgia, the governor of Alabama now want high speed between Atlanta and Birmingham. Florida, as a result of the vote of its citizens, is now working with us and others to begin planning a high speed system. The 9 states in the Midwest. I was out there last week, Tom, for a full day in Chicago, and let me tell you, they're not prepared to wait around. And if you know anything about congestion around Chicago, a few years ago, I spoke at the University of Indiana at Gary, which is about, what, 50 miles east of Chicago?
Most.
It took me longer by car to go from O'Hare to Gary, Indiana at 2 o'clock in the afternoon than it did to fly from Boston to Chicago. It's a mess, and they know it. So the first 3 corridors in the Midwest, which we are already now beginning to work on and are under construction in cooperation with the states, are Chicago, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee.
We all know the pain of that kind of traffic jam, but do we trust Amtrak to fix it? I want to expand our circle, Michael Dukakis, and welcome in now Nancy Rutledge Connery. She's a member of the Amtrak Reform Council, a group established by the government to monitor the financial performance of the National Rail Passenger Service. Good evening, Nancy Rutledge Connery.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
And tell him you're one of my former students, Nancy.
trying to get that upper hand right away.
Absolutely.
Nancy.
And she was a good one, let me say.
Well, then we'll see what she's got to say. Nancy, you watch Amtrak very closely. You hear Michael Dukakis' enthusiasm for this expansion of its service and his call for more federal funds to go in there. Should we do that? And if we did, can Amtrak take this money and make good use of it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The majority of the Amtrak Reform Council, an overwhelming majority, would agree wholeheartedly with much of what Governor Dukakis just said about the need for much better levels of service of passenger rail service, particularly in those high-density corridors. There's really no question if one of the lessons that we learned out of this terrible tragedy in the United States is that we must have some better options, particularly where there's a lot of people need to move very quickly under very difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. We don't have it right now. My concern about Amtrak's role as a sole provider, arbiter of that, is that their track record hasn't been very good.
On what score, Nancy Rutledge Connery?
I'm talking, you can just call me Nancy.
Okay. You got a long one there.
Yes, right. It's kind of like a big black box into which a lot of money goes, and it gets divided up in some very mysterious ways at times. It's very hard getting very clear information out of the company. But in any event, what we do know is that we're not investing enough, for instance, in that Northeast Corridor. Governor Dukakis talked about those beautiful Acela trains, and I would agree. I've ridden them myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you get very frustrated by the fact that it goes 150 miles an hour only for about 13 seconds.
So what's the problem? Is that a management issue?
Well, in part it is, and it's also the fact that they have a lot of competing goals and political masters, if you will, all over the country. And so that money that perhaps should be reinvested from the revenues of the Acela, which is, or for that matter, all of the trains on the Northeast Corridor, which are the only ones in the system that really do make return revenues, profits to the company at a fully allocated basis, so that that money is not invested back into the infrastructure. And so they're now, by Amtrak's own numbers, about $20 billion short of really good working order. And that's, that's a big chunk of change just to bring that corridor up to a level where that beautiful Acela train could actually ride right for more than 13 seconds.
So, Nancy, I want to be sure I understand your fundamental critique. Is it that Amtrak is somehow constitutionally not capable of spending this money well? Is it that the rails ought to be privatized?
Yes.
What's your formula here?
Well, the Amtrak Reform Council is struggling with that idea right now, and precisely how that, our committee's outcome will be, I'm not going to predict, but I will tell you from my own vantage point that I would love to see that the operations and the infrastructure be divided of Amtrak. In other words, that Northeast Corridor, which is the only piece of infrastructure they really own. Otherwise, they ride on freight rail tracks, throughout the
And anybody who's ridden knows that the passenger train waits for the freight train when it's behind you.
That's right.
Pulls over and waits.
In those high-speed corridors, there is, I think, at least some willingness on the part of the freights to actually step up to the plate, and particularly where there is investment money, they need capacity in many of those corridors as well. And there are opportunities for improving service for both freight and passenger service, but it doesn't necessarily have to be Amtrak providing that service.
Mike Dukakis, what about it? Nancy Rutledge Connery says maybe Amtrak is not prepared to handle the kind of money you're talking about bringing in and do a good job with it.
Well, I would simply point to the Northeast Corridor. We've been saying for years, and by the way, Tom, I go back to 1975 with this because I was the lead governor for the Northeast Governors pushing for the Northeast Corridor project.
We know you're a train rider, too.
Well, but it was more than that, and we were talking about this. And what we said was, look, give us sufficient amounts of money to invest in the hardware, the tracks, the trains, the signal systems, the grade crossings, and so forth, and we'll run a hell of a train for you. And that's exactly what happened finally. It took forever. And we're now running a hell of a train. Now, Nancy's right. We could be running faster. Why aren't we? Well, because we don't own a piece of the infrastructure between New Haven and New York. That's owned by Metro North, and they haven't overhauled the overhead electrical system in 80 years. It's now in the process of doing it. It should have been done 25 years ago.
So is Amtrak the right operation then to push this forward, or should we have a radical new approach somehow?
Well,
privatize and
well, what did we do in the Northeast Corridor? I mean, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. When given sufficient funds to invest, we've done the job. And, I remember when rail passenger service in this country was privatized, and it was awful. Now, if people want to go back to that, good luck to them. If they want to give us what we now have with the airlines, which, by the way, not only get huge subsidies, but went to Washington, as we know, the other day and got billions more because they're out of cash.
15, 17.
so be it. But, I used to run a railroad. It was called the MBTA. And in this state, as you know, the governor runs it. And we've got the best public transportation system in America. And it does its own construction, and it owns its own infrastructure, and it operates, gets subsidies, because it's a public service. But it's the best public transportation system in America.
Nancy, jump in here. What do you make of Mike Dukakis' case?
Well, I think he's perhaps overstating Amtrak's ability to do that. We look at their numbers very closely, and those numbers that, are vetted by them. And, in fact, in this last year, their losses exceeded $1 billion. For the purposes of our purposes, there's only a small percentage of that we're gauging the so-called self-sufficiency test, which we've declared that they will not meet. But the problem is that they were not able to demonstrate, other than a small increase in ridership, and revenues, their expenditures went through the roof. They were so much higher. I mean, they've been rising along with their overhead, even as, you know, they saw that they were going to have significant problems getting the Accela trains on board as fast as they wanted to. And, you know, we see the long-haul trains across the country soaking up hundreds of millions of dollars with very, very minimal revenue coming back. And it seems to me that there might be some other opportunities. If you take that infrastructure off the balance sheet of Amtrak and begin to look at the corridors as opportunities, not just for Amtrak, but actually opportunities to develop, you know, multi-state authorities or some kind of partnership with the federal government. There will undoubtedly have to be significant federal money investment in this. But there also needs to be investment from the states to keep this honest. And also the opportunity for other private companies who are actually providing rail service all over the world.
Nancy Rutledge Connery, I've got to let our callers come in there. We have a lot of them who are waiting.
Okay.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Yale is on the line. Welcome, Yale.
Hi. I think the governor's comment just a few minutes ago about the Boston metropolitan area
and the public transport system there.
And the public transport system and his reference to it as a public service is where the key to what we've done over the past 50 years really lies, and where the great disparity between rail service in the United States and rail service in Europe.
So, Yale, you're voting for a government subsidy.
Not just government. In Europe, the rail service is considered as essential a public service as police protection or fire protection. No one asks whether the fire department pays for itself or whether the police department earns enough to cover the wages.
We got it. Yale, your radio's echoing in our ear. We're going to have to let you go. But Mike Dukakis, here's a vote for the government coming in and helping us have a rail system more like Europe's. Is it feasible in the U.S., given the kind of restraints that you and Nancy Rutledge Connery are talking about?
Of course it's feasible. It all depends on whether or not we want to invest in it. We have in metropolitan areas all over the country public service corporations which run transit systems. And on the whole, they do quite well. Now, those systems used to be privatized, and they went bankrupt. And the idea of bringing that back strikes me as being kind of preposterous. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Yale's right. This is a public service. And in metropolitan regions all over the country, it's considered to be that. I don't care whether you're riding the MBTA in Boston or New York Transit or BART in San Francisco or the Metro in Washington.
Nancy Rutledge Connery, we've just got a minute before the break. Last word from you.
Well, I think he's imposing an old model on what we're talking about. There are a much more robust ways of organizing the private sector with government support and with government oversight to create a much more demonstrably financially sound system than we've got right now.
Are you saying that a private system could work, or a private system with airline-style government support?
It's going to be a combination of both private and public, and definitely the government will have to be a lead player in terms of overseeing the system and providing some kind of direction to keep the politics down to a minimum.
Nancy Rutledge Connery, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Nancy Rutledge Connery is a member of the Amtrak Reform Council, a group established by the government to monitor the financial performance of the National Rail Passenger Service. We're talking about the U.S. rail system tonight and Amtrak. Have you ridden it lately? Have you ridden it since 9/11? How was it for you? Would you like to see more government support for it, more high-speed rail across the country? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Amtrak and the U.S. rail system. Can it be better? Would you like to ride it more? What would it take to get you on? Have you ridden the Accela train, and did it accelerate you? Will you use it again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Michael Dukakis, former governor of Massachusetts and acting chairman of Amtrak's board of directors. You can join us here or online at WBUR.org. Click on special coverage forums. Right now, Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hello, Professor Dukakis. This is Bruce McHenry.
Hi, Bruce.
I hate to come against you on this debate because you're such a great polemicist, and I like you very much as a person.
Thank you, sir.
But I think you're absolutely on the wrong side of the government investment in this issue. I'd like to say that I do write Amtrak to New York because I'd like to work on the computer. But for $2 to $3 billion in public investment, I think we can do much, much better.
Much better in what way, Bruce?
Well, trains are old technology. You have to get to the station. They make stops. You have to get from the station to where you're going.
So what do you want, the Segway human transport, or what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is a vehicle. It's a combination of cars and trains. If you look at the fraction of time that the train is actually occupying the right-of-way, it is minute.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can get cars running down that right-of-way following each other in platoons, it could be train length or even longer, but able to separate individually at each one of the exits or entrance ramps, then you could have a system which 100% of this country would subscribe to.
So a kind of roll-on, roll-off system where cars could themselves join trains.
Absolutely. It's a major infrastructure investment, but it's the kind of thing which is going to be coming. And for investing in Amtrak is never going to make money. Let's face it squarely. It's not an investment, Professor Dukakis. It's a subsidy. And in come 20 years, it'll probably be a outmoded technology. So why push that? Why not at least say that you're going to put half of this call for Amtrak into investment in research and development and intelligent transportation systems?
Bruce, thanks for your call. Mike Dukakis, what about it? Are we using last century's technology in the 21st century? Should we have something entirely different, be envisioning a kind of, or is this science fiction that Bruce is giving us?
No, I respect Bruce's view of this, and I think we ought to be looking at these. But frankly, to have, if I understand what he's proposing, individuals and individual cars moving along a right-of-way is an impossible thing to accommodate. Can you imagine thousands of people in Boston getting on a right-of-way and trying to get down to New York?
But what about his fundamental point, then, that the rail is kind of an outmoded system? It doesn't make use often enough, intensely enough, of the right-of-way that it has.
Tokyo to Kyoto, and you know Japan,
mm-hmm.
is about 300 miles.
Mm-hmm.
They have 190-mile-an-hour high-speed trains, bullet trains, operating over that right-of-way every 12 minutes from 6 in the morning till 9 at night. Now, if that isn't using that capacity, and by the way, thousands of people, as you know, ride that every day.
Sure, it's full all the time.
If that isn't using that capacity, I don't know what is. And frankly, I think given the ridership numbers we're looking at on the Acela Express just in this first year, we'll be increasing the number of trains, we'll be increasing frequencies, we'll be hitching up two of these trains together and running them down during rush hour. There is huge capacity in rail, far more than there is on a highway and far more than there is in an airport.
Bruce, Mike Dukakis isn't buying it tonight, but keep us posted on this. Mary Beth is on the line. Welcome, Mary Beth. You're on the air.
Thanks. Yeah, I was just calling in regards to a trip that I recently took on Thanksgiving Day on the Acela.
Oh, good. Tell us.
Well, I thought it was lovely. I left Boston on time. I was actually on what they call a quiet car.
What does that mean, Mary Beth?
I guess it's supposed to mean that there's no cell phones allowed and also no loud conversations.
So was it quiet?
Well, we were quiet for 5 minutes. At the first stop at Back Bay, a young infant got on who cried a good bit of the way.
Reproduction issue.
Yeah, well, no, I loved the train. I thought it was very pleasant. It was about 10 minutes late, which was not bad, into New York. I do think it's expensive, and I think a number of people will not take that train because of the cost.
Expensive compared to what, Mary Beth?
Well, compared to the bus, because on the way back...
What did it cost, by the way?
Because it was considered non-peak mm-hmm. on Thanksgiving Day as opposed to the day before, mm-hmm. it was $99 one way.
Okay.
I came home on a bus, mm-hmm. just got myself to Port Authority and took the first bus that was leaving. That was $45. And that bus actually, the minute we had enough passengers to fill a bus, it actually left early.
Mm-hmm.
It was nonstop, and it made it from Port Authority to South Station in almost exactly 4 hours. So time-wise, they were equivalent. I do think the Acela was more pleasant. I thought it was clean.
Mm-hmm.
It was very pleasant to be on it. But I think for half the price, I couldn't fault the bus. And I think there's a lot of people that love the idea of the Acela, but I'm not sure that it's going to be full, other than businessmen during, you know, sort of peak times of day. It certainly was not full the day I took it.
Mary Beth, thanks so much for your call. Michael Dukakis, what about train versus bus? Mary Beth says it's half the price, not as nice, but it's just about as fast. Will the train compete?
We've got a choice for Mary Beth. If it's more expensive than she would like to pay, although it's half the price of the air shuttle, then she should take the Acela Regional.
Now, what's that?
That's about $60. Makes the trip in about 4 hours, 4 hours and 10 minutes, downtown to downtown. Mm-hmm. It's very attractive. It's very pleasant.
It's a slower trip. A little bit.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we get closer and closer to 3 hours from Boston to New York and 2.5 hours from New York to Washington, there'll be some differential. But if she has 4 hours to spend, and that's not that much, and she obviously did so on the bus.
And she likes the environment.
She likes the environment. The Acela Regional is the thing to take, and it'll get her down there in about 4 hours, 4 hours and 10 minutes, and she'll love it. And, by the way, again, computer compatible. Easy, walk around. We have a quiet car on the Acela Regional.
Computer compatible meaning there's a table for your laptop.
Well, and there's a plug-in.
For power.
Yeah.
Oh, great, great. Mike Dukakis, we have more callers who want to join us. Eva's on the line. Welcome, Eva. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I've been taking the train for years, both before and after September 11th, and I think it's the only civilized way to travel. But I'd like to bring up an issue that I don't think has been touched on, and that is the question of how much energy it takes per passenger mile to move people by train versus bus versus plane versus car. And I've seen some statistics, which I can't remember, which indicate the train is many, many times more efficient than any other method. And I wonder whether Governor Dukakis has any figures in his head.
Eva, thanks for your call. What about the environmental?
I can't give you
comparison?
The precise figures, but there's no question that we have far more energy efficient, cost effective, and environmentally, if I may say, environmentally benign or contribute more to the environment than these other forms of transportation. Now, don't get me wrong, Tom. I mean, I drive a car and I fly around a lot. But for trips of up to 300 or 350 miles between cities, there's simply no comparison.
Mike,
a high-speed train can do it better, faster, more effectively, and more efficiently from an energy standpoint.
Can we get any closer to Eva's question there in terms of the environmental advantage of the train?
I can't give you the precise figures except to say that every study I have seen indicates quite clearly that the train is by far, from an environmental standpoint, by far the best way to go.
We've been talking a lot about the Acela, but I want to look beyond that for a minute and think about how you're going to build the constituency for this. You know, in much of the rest of the country, the experience isn't so great. I have a story from my own parents who earlier this year, they were taking the train across the Midwest. The train stops in the middle of an Indiana cornfield. And the PA comes on and announces that the crew has worked its full shift and they've got to finish now. They've got to be done. The train sits in the cornfield for almost 3 hours until finally a new crew arrives by taxi from some city. I don't know where. They got lost in the cornfields. The new engineer shows up. They finally take off. Dining car empty. Nothing to drink. Hot and sweltering. This is not an experience that will bring people back.
I'm not sure what happened there, Tom. And, of course, part of our problem, as Nancy pointed out, is that we're operating outside of the Northeast over freight lines. So often we'll be stopped in the middle of a cornfield because it's a single-track line and a freight train is making a crew change.
But this looks like just bad management.
Well,
the engineer's time runs out in the middle of nowhere and you wait for a taxi to show up with a new engineer.
I can't tell you what specific. All I can tell you is this. Kitty and I had two of the best days of our lives when in early September we flew out to Denver where my daughter, as you may know, is a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. We picked up her son, our 3-year-old grandson, put him on the California Zephyr, which is one of our great trains from Chicago to Oakland. Over the Rocky Mountains during the day in an observation car. The food was fabulous. The service was terrific. And I hear that as well. Now, let me say this, Tom. We've got to decide in this country not only that we're going to invest in high-speed corridors of 300, 350 miles, and we must. And that's why 38 states and 38 governors, Republicans as well as Democrats, Jesse Helms, Trent Watt, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, all sponsors of the High-Speed Rail Investment Act. So there's a very broad constituency for this. Those we must do. They're absolutely critical. The long-distance trains, in my judgment, are just as important. Now, Nancy's right. We're never going to make money on those. We'll make money on the high-speed corridors. We're making a lot of money on the Acela Express, and we'll make money on any of these high-speed corridors. But I think in order to connect the system, in order to provide service to communities that don't have any other way to move in and out, it's important that we do that. Now, how do we do it on the air side? We subsidize the airlines. Been doing it for years to provide what is called essential service. And yet, we don't blanch at that. We don't think there's anything wrong with that. But when it comes to providing public support for these long-distance lines, we say, well, that's money down a rat hole. We shouldn't do that. Why don't they make money and so on?
We've got this 1997 law that requires Amtrak to break even in its operations by 2003 or face disillusion. We've just got 30 seconds left, but is Amtrak going to make it? What's going to happen?
Yes, Amtrak is going to make it. I can't guarantee you that we're going to be operationally self-sufficient, although I can tell you this new board, and I've only been on it 3.5 years now, so I can't vouch for what happened before. All I can tell you is we're working our heads off. This is a much better company today than it was 3.5 years ago. It's a much better managed company than it was 3.5 years ago. It's much more entrepreneurial than it was 3.5 years ago. And it has demonstrated beyond doubt that with the necessary capital investment, it can run a first-class, modern, high-speed rail line and make money. And if we can do that all over the country, then I believe we will be operationally self-sufficient, and we can use some of that money to subsidize these longer-distance lines.
Mike Dukakis, it looks like you're having some fun trying to get that done.
I'm having a ball.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Michael Dukakis, former governor of Massachusetts and acting chairman of Amtrak's board of directors. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Around the country, reservists who have yet to be called to active duty wait to see if they will be called to serve in the war on terrorism. But while they wait, so do their friends and family. Pam Childers is 17 years old. In this radio diary, she shares her feelings about the possibility that her mother, a naval reservist, might be sent abroad.
The day I found out my mom had to call a local recruiter and register as a standby reserve for the war in Afghanistan, I nearly lost my mind. All kinds of thoughts went through my head. I didn't know what to do. All my life, it's always been just my mom and me. And if I were to lose her, it would tear my world apart. Before, I was never able to understand how people felt when they had a father, cousin, or uncle go off to war. Now it was my turn to find out what it was like, and I was scared and confused. It's not very common for a woman to go off to war, so I didn't have anyone I could relate to or could give me advice on how to deal with my situation. I wanted to tell my mom how I felt so she could take care of me like she always has, but she was already stressed out from the idea of having to go to war. I felt sorry for her. She was stuck being a single parent, paying bills, and on top of it all, having to worry about risking her life in battle. I remember when I was 4 years old and my mom went off to the Navy. When she left, she made sure I was old enough to know who she was. She didn't want to leave and have a daughter growing up without any idea who her mom was. It was really hard for me because everywhere I went, I saw people with their moms, and it made me miss her. I didn't have a mom to run to when I fell and hurt myself or to tuck me in at night. Now that I'm older and have even a closer relationship with her, I know it would be harder for me to let her go. Even the simple things would be so much harder, like waking up in the morning and eating breakfast without her there to say good morning and kiss me on the cheek. I still don't know just how it feels to have a loved one leave for war, but I'm getting closer to finding out. If it happens, I know I won't be able to accept it, and I'm not prepared for it.
Pam Childers lives in San Pablo, California. Her commentary came from Youth Radio. We'd like to hear your stories. Send your submission by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is